And so one of them is a man called Herbert Ribton, an Irishman from mm-hmm. Dublin, who was living in Italy. And he reads Adventist literature, and in 1876 he becomes an Adventist. Andrews visits Italy from Switzerland and baptizes him. He's living in Naples, and he starts his own ministry. He starts his own church. Mm. He's not a missionary per se, mm-hmm. because he was already living there converted by literature, but he begins his own ministry. Mm. And then actually he does go as a missionary because he goes to Egypt and starts the Adventist work in Egypt. Unfortunately, he's killed in a civil war there in 1882, and his work, the small group of believers mm-hmm. he built up, who were all foreigners, all returned to their homelands.
The Lineage Journey Podcast, unscripted conversations that aim to help you on the journey of discovering your lineage. Join us as we take a deeper look into past lineage episodes and see the lessons we can learn for today.
I'd like to welcome those of you who are listening to our Lineage Journey Podcast. If you've been following our journey, we interview with various people who are experts in their field of study or work, and we delve a little bit deeper in some of the topics we've looked at with lineage. Today, I'm joined by Dr. David Trim.
Hello, Adam. Good to be with you.
Thank you for taking the time. I know you're very busy.
My pleasure.
And you work here at the General Conference. This is where we are.
Yes.
And I believe you've held the position that you're in since 2010, if I'm correct.
That's right, since October of 2010.
Okay, so you're the Director of...
Archives, Statistics, and Research.
Research, but... Your own background prior to that, you're a historian.
Yes. Yes. I was born in India, where my parents were missionaries.
Okay.
My childhood was in Sydney, Australia. My father was Australian. My mother is English. And then I went to college at Newbold College in England, and I later taught there for 10 years. And then for 2 years at Pacific Union College near San Francisco in California, mm-hmm. and then came to the General Conference in 2010.
Okay. When you went to Newbold as a young man, was that the first time you really lived or spent time in England?
It wasn't the first time I'd lived in England, but it was the first time I'd lived there for more than a few months.
Okay, okay. And you have, from what I've seen, you have your PhD is from King's College in London?
King's College London, that's right.
Okay. And you've written a number of books as well, if I'm correct?
Yes, yeah, it's up to 15 at the moment.
Okay. Now... One of the books you recently wrote, which was about the church in Europe.
Yes.
Trans-European Division in particular. I think it's called A Passion for Mission.
That's right. It came out in 2019.
Okay. Would you mind sharing a little bit about the title and what inspired you to write the book?
The inspiration to write the book was a request from the Trans-European Division to write a history for their 95th anniversary.
Okay.
And so I agreed and started to do the research and the work, became fascinated by the subject, ended up writing longer than they were probably expecting, though still didn't exhaust the topics, the possibilities of the topic by any means. Mm-hmm. And I called it A Passion for Mission because that, to me, summed up the character of the Trans-European Division over its 90 years of history, that people in what used to be called the Northern European mm-hmm. Division, then it became the Trans-European Division, have a passion for mission.
I bought the book a couple of years ago.
Oh, good.
And
I don't get any royalties, but I'm glad you bought it even so.
I did, and got the hard copy next to my bed. I'm still plowing my way through, but I was fascinated by the history of it, at least what I've read so far. And you know, growing up in the Trans-European Division, you know, maybe this is my ignorance, but I had no idea that the Trans-European Division was responsible for half of Africa for most of its existence.
Right. I mean, people will look at it and say Northern European Division, well, that's not very much.
Mm-hmm.
But the church, and this is a way in which the church always reflects wider society, even when we think we're not reflecting wider society. We always do to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
The church mimicked the power structures of European empires because it arose in the era of European empires. And so the Southern European Division, which was the Latin language-speaking countries around the Mediterranean, had mission fields. which were parts of Francophone Africa and Italian, the French colonies in Africa, the Italian colonies in Africa, because it was, and the Spanish colonies, because it was France, Italy, Spain, and Portugal, and had the Portuguese colonies as well. And then the Northern European division had the British colonies, as well as some of the French colonies in Africa as well, because Britain was in the Northern European division. And so because Britain had such a large part of Africa as its empire, the Northern European division, when it was founded, was actually responsible for more of Africa than the then African division. It was responsible for all of East Africa and for West Africa. Now, eventually, East Africa was moved on to what was then called the Trans-African Division. But even so, for about 15 years, the Northern European Division was responsible for East Africa, and it was responsible for West Africa all the way up until 1980. So, and then in the 1980s, it was given Pakistan, and in the 1990s, the Middle East.
So you would remember that.
So, you know, the division, which is focused around Scandinavia and Britain and parts of Eastern Europe and historically has been, also has historically had large parts of the rest of the world that it's been responsible for. So actually the history of the Trans-European Division is to some extent the history of the world church.
It's fascinating. Did I mean, because I know Britain had some colonies in Southern Africa as well.
The church had a separate founding in South Africa. They sent missionaries there from America in the late 1880s. And so South Africa always had its own sort of center of gravity, so to speak. And so South Africa, what was then called Rhodesia, which today is Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Malawi, and also the modern country of Botswana and Namibia, those were all under what was called the African Division and then later the Trans-African Division, with its headquarters first in South Africa and then after apartheid in what is today Zimbabwe.
Fascinating. So I don't want to open a can of worms, but I mean, this idea of the church mimicking society, you kind of have essentially the colonies. That's where the mission, those countries were responsible for the countries that they, quote unquote, were running, you know.
No, that's right. And it's partly a practical measure, because to get permissions from governments to work in those colonies, you had to apply to the colonial power. So to work in French West Africa, you needed to apply to the French government. To work in British colonies, you needed ideally to have permissions from the British government. But I do think that it was partly just an almost unspoken assumption that just as the European powers have colonies, so the European church would have its own quote-unquote colonies. Of course, there was a different mindset in that there was a desire to help the people, not exploit them. To work for them and a love for the people. But nevertheless, that kind of imperialist mindset was still there. And actually, the Euro-Africa division only ceased to have control of African territories in the 21st century. Now it's the inter-European division because Africa isn't left.
Now, did this apply to other parts of the world, like, you know, the Indonesia, Dutch, and South America?
It did. When there used to be one from 1909, there was a European division. And because it was also responsible for the European colonies, it was basically responsible for half the world. So it was just too much. So in 1928, it was decided to split the European division. And in 1929, that took place. They split it into three, the Southern, Northern, and Central European divisions. Central European division was Germany, essentially, and the German-speaking parts of Europe, which was where the membership was largest. In fact, if you go back to the early 20th century, there was a period when the church in the German-speaking countries of Europe was growing faster than the church in North America. And the war and what happened around the war, both world wars, kind of wrecked that.
It's still a fairly strong church there, though, numerically wise.
Compared to the other parts of Europe, that's correct. But, I mean, it was growing even faster. But as a result of the First World War, Germany lost all its colonies. So you couldn't give them mission fields in the rest of the world, but you had to have a Central European division because the German-speaking church was so strong. And this was one reason they gave mission fields to the Northern and Southern European divisions, so that they could actually have enough responsibilities to justify being a division. But the German-speaking Adventists basically said, we want our mission fields too. And so they took what was then the Dutch East Indies, today's modern country of Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And back then, the Netherlands was with the Central European Division. Mm-hmm. After World War II, it was put with the Northern European mm-hmm. Division. And ever since, it's part of the Trans-European Division now. But initially, it was with the Central European Division. And so they took the Dutch East Indies and put it, for the first 4 years, 5 years, with the Central European Division. But this was crazy because it's a phenomenal mm-hmm. distance. It's much further even than Africa.
You got to go across a few oceans to get there.
Right. It's on the other side of the world. And also, the local Adventist missionaries working there had got used to relating to the other missionaries in Malaysia, what was then Malaya, mm-hmm. Singapore, and the Philippines. That was who they related to because they were just across, in the case of Malaya and Singapore, they were just across a narrow strait of water. Mm. And so now suddenly they're told, no, you can't relate to the people who are culturally like you.
Same as you got to go.
You've got to relate all the way back to a church headquarters in Hamburg. And fortunately, people worked out fairly quickly that that wasn't going to work. And so at the next general... Sorry, this was 1929. And so at the 1936 General Conference session, they put the Dutch East Indies back with what was then called the Far East Division so that it could relate to mm-hmm. other countries nearby and similar cultures and so forth. So that made a lot of sense. But for those first several years, actually, what is today Indonesia was under a headquarters in Hamburg, which of course makes no sense, it was taking that principle that kind of made sense and mm-hmm. implementing it to a degree that didn't make sense.
And what about South America? Were they all with independent countries or?
Yeah, so Inter-America and South America became their own divisions relatively quickly because those weren't, there are some European colonies in the Inter-American division in the Caribbean mm-hmm. and the French, British and Dutch Guiana. Mm-hmm. But they were always part of the Inter-American Division, which was like the South American Division. They were both created relatively early and, in fact, before the European Division split.
Fascinating. So the TED now is probably at its smallest size it's
absolutely.
Ever been.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Been. Smallest it's ever been.
Wow. I'm just, I guess I have an interest in the TED because I live there and...
Yes. Well, and as I said, it's had a tremendous influence on the rest of the world. Even though it's the smallest world division today in terms of mm-hmm. its membership, it has packed a much bigger punch. It's punched above its weight. And in particular, it laid the foundations for successful mission across much of Africa. And today's thriving churches in East Africa and West Africa owe something. One wouldn't want to exaggerate it because the biggest growth came relatively recently, but nevertheless, the foundations were laid mm-hmm. by missionaries from Britain and Scandinavia in particular.
Fascinating. So the Adventist Church, let's go kind of go back a bit to the very beginning. It's formed in the 1860s, and it takes us about 14 years or so to send our first official missionary out. We've mentioned a little bit, but how long was it? That first missionary was Jane Andrews, who goes
right.
to...
Right. So the General Conference gets founded, in effect, founding the Seventh-day Adventist mm-hmm. Church, which is what my most recent book is actually about, is how we get from being Millerites in 1844 to Seventh-day Adventists. How you get from being Millerite Adventists, because they didn't call themselves Millerites.
They didn't, yeah.
They called themselves Adventists. How do you get from being General Adventists in 1844 to Seventh-day Adventists in 1863? That's what my latest book is about. And so they found the church in 1863, and it's 11 years later that they send Jay and Andrews. But of course, the movement had existed before they coalesced and mm-hmm. formally founded the church in 1863. And so it's 30 years, actually, after the Great Disappointment. Mm-hmm. And Seventh-day Adventists had effectively started to form as a movement, a very small movement, but as a movement in the 1850s. And it's in 1859 that the first Sabbath-keeping Adventist writes to the church's paper and says, is the third angel's message to be proclaimed outside America? And at that stage, the answer was no, Adam, because the answer was, we can fulfill the prophecies that says the gospel will be preached to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people by preaching to the representatives of those peoples who've emigrated to the United States. So it's an incredibly narrow-minded, parochial, and exclusive vision.
You just hope your country's represented in America.
That's right. That's right. And what happened? How are you then supposed to hear about it in your own country if it's only being preached to a narrow group of immigrants in the United States? So it takes a good 15 years before Sabbath-keeping Adventists are able to say, no, we do have a responsibility to the rest of the world.
Hmm. And how soon was it from, say, Jay and Andrew going to Europe that we then cover at least every continent?
That's a great question. And the interesting thing is, of course, in you know, looking back at it, one could say, well, maybe sending Jay and Andrews needn't have been a turning point, because it turns out to be rather more difficult to maintain a foreign missionary than anyone had imagined.
Mm-hmm.
Unsurprisingly, you know, without instant communication, the finances, exactly. How do you actually do this?
How do you budget for it?
How do you budget for it? How do you raise the money for it? How does John and Andrews himself have to work with these people? They were expecting the Swiss believers who were already there. We can talk about that later if you like, but they actually predate the first official missionary. Mm-hmm. They were expecting the Swiss believers to pay for the mission themselves, and they're actually too poor to do so. Mm-hmm. So you could imagine American Adventists in 1875 or 1876 saying, whoa, this isn't what we signed up for. Let's just pull our horns back in and let's concentrate on America again. But actually that doesn't happen. And after they send Andrews out, they send other missionaries to help him. They arrive in January of 1876. They send more in 77. And then in 1877, they send John Matteson, a Danish-American, to the three Scandinavian countries. In 1878, they send John N. Loughborough to the British Isles. And then in the 1880s, they go to Australia and South Africa in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an initial reaching out to South America in a very tentative way. But nevertheless, we can say within 15 years of Andrews being sent out, by the end of the 1880s, mm-hmm. Adventists have worked or are working or have a presence on every inhabited continent.
Mm. Okay.
And so that happens relatively quickly, but one wouldn't want to overstate the significance of that, because in many cases you're talking about a very small handful of believers or workers, but mm-hmm. nevertheless they have got a presence in every continent.
Hmm. And was this intentional, organic, or was it just once we sent the first, was it now like, okay, we've got to strategically plan, or was it just...
It was a mix of both. It's... One of the strongest advocates for saying Adventists only needed to preach to immigrants in the United States was Uriah Smith, who was the editor of the church's paper, The Review, and secretary of the General Conference for many years. And he writes articles in The Review, at least three, making this point that, you know, we only need to worry about America. And yet within less than a year of Andrews going out, Smith is writing in The Review and saying, no, we have a message that is worldwide. That's his word, worldwide. And so, you can imagine the situation where there's a dam that has a small crack in it that gradually builds up and up until the dam bursts. And I think that was what was happening with Seventh-day Adventists. I think deep down they knew that they needed to do more, but they couldn't. It took a little while to overcome their America-centric prejudices, and it probably took them a little while to imagine they could even do this.
Mm.
I mean, there was maybe 3,000 Adventists when they founded the church. How can a group that small, even a group the size of it was in 1874, how can you have a six-continent mission strategy?
Mm.
The amazing thing is that they do. But so I think that it took the time, and once the crack in the dam wall took effect, then it burst, and then there was no turning back.
Mm.
There was no turning back.
Once you commit that way, you're going to...
Absolutely. And so Andrews going is a pivotal moment, not because Andrews himself is the pivotal person, because Andrews just happens to be the person they choose. I wouldn't want to underestimate the commitment of that, because it's an extraordinary thing to do. He takes his two motherless children with him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge commitment, but nevertheless, he happens to be the person that they choose.
So he was chosen, not volunteered.
It's a mix. I mean, they're looking for somebody to send, and they want to send one of the most capable people they have, and that's Andrews.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't have gone if he hadn't wanted to.
Yeah.
And he himself has already shown an interest in the Adventists in Switzerland. So it's partly, we don't know the exact details, but it's a mix of being asked and being willing to go.
Okay.
But nevertheless, the key is that Andrew's going is the moment of no turning back. And then they send more missionaries and more and more and more. And it's like the ever-expanding torrent through that broken dam.
Hmm.
And so that's the significance of Andrew's, and that's the significance of that moment, that once Adventists have finally done it, then they realize there's no turning back, and they're going to keep on sending more. So it's partly an organic belief, but it is partly planned, because once Andrews goes and then has troubles and is writing back saying this is more difficult than, you know, than perhaps I'd envisage, that's when they send Daniel Bordeaux and his wife at the end of 1875. He was actually... early Adventists talk about overseas mission, which is technically correct because they did have believers in Canada. In fact, there were Millerites in Canada, just because, of course, you've got a porous border between America and Canada at that stage, and you've got believers in the province of Quebec in Canada. And two of them are Daniel Bordeaux and Augustin Bordeaux, who are important early workers. And so they send Daniel Bordeaux probably because he can speak French. So he's a natural person to send. And then they realize, though, by 1877, Andrews needs more reinforcements. And because he's, for various reasons, focusing on a very literature-heavy ministry, he's focusing on an Adventist journal called Les Signes des Temps, French for Signs of the Times, and various tracts and pamphlets. They decide we need to send people who are experts in literature evangelism, colporteurs. And meanwhile, John Matteson has been campaigning for some time saying, send me. And they know that they have believers in Scandinavia because there was a huge amount of emigration from Scandinavia to the United States in the mid-19th century, especially to the states of Wisconsin and Minnesota. And so people there are sending Adventist literature back to their families in Scandinavia. And so they know by 1877, we have individual believers in Denmark and Norway and Sweden. And so Matteson is saying, send me. And so there is a degree of planning to it. And then one of the people who they send to join Andrews, William Ings, visits England where he has family and discovers an interest in the Seventh-day Sabbath. So Andrew sends him back to actually work in England, and he says, yes, there is an interest. We need a full-time missionary to Britain, and it needs to be an experienced man. So they send John Loughborough, who's one of the most experienced evangelists the church has. So they, I think you get a sense of how it was both organic, but also a degree of planning. And then when it comes to going to Australia, which is the first really big, going far away, because after all, there was a lot of communication between Europe and America. Going to Australia, now that's a different thing. It takes a month.
Like frontier work.
Yeah, and it takes a month just to sail there. That is a matter of planning, because Stephen Haskell, an early church leader who's in California, is thinking about where can we go next. And his attention, for various reasons, gets drawn to Australia. And they start sending the Tract in Literature Society in California. Tract in Literature Societies were our early literature evangelism instruments. And the Tract in Literature Society starts sending Adventist literature to Australia. What they do is they go to public libraries in California, get postal office directories for Australia, and just start sending literature initially to libraries and then to just people whose addresses they pull out of these post office directories. Goodness only knows what they thought of it. But eventually the idea dawns that this isn't the most effective way if you're wanting to reach Australia, because it takes so long. They do get some letters back from people saying, yes, I've read this, but of course it's taken maybe 3 months round trip.
There's no real dialogue.
Right. And so that's when Haskell actually starts to campaign and says, we should send a party of missionaries to Australia. He promotes that at the California conference, and then at the general conference session, they decide to do it, and they don't just send Haskell and his wife. They send a large party of missionaries, including colporteurs, including a printer. So they're already thinking about, we need to have our own local printing ministry and a teacher. So that's by 1885, you're definitely seeing strategic thinking come in the way that they decide to go to Australia and then in who they decide to send to Australia. And that thereafter tends to be the case much more. But in those early years, it is a mix of both organic, just happening, and then also but some strategic thinking as well.
Okay. Fascinating. Appreciate that background of the world and the early parts of missions. We're going to get into, you mentioned the work in Switzerland and how that even started. We'll get into that in just a minute. In fact, I think we'll get into that after the break. So we'll just pause.
All right.
We'll just pause for a minute. Thank you for sharing the history. Coming up after the break, we're going to look at how did the work start, the origins before Jay and Andrews got to Europe, you know,
yes.
what led to that, and what are some of the other missionaries who went out maybe without permission, or so should I say, and look at some of the impact today. So stay with us, those of you who are listening, and we'll be back after the break in just a minute.
Lineage is a non-profit organization kept running by generous donors like you. Support us today on patreon.com/lineagejourney.
Today's episode of our podcast is brought to you by Advent Digital Marketing, a full-service digital marketing agency that specializes in helping Adventist ministries secure more donors and Adventist businesses boost their online sales. With Advent Digital Marketing's expertise in online marketing, your organization can achieve its fundraising and revenue goals. Visit www.adventdigitalmarketing.com to schedule your free consultation today.
The Reformation is synonymous with men like Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli. When we think of that period of time, it's their names and their stories that leap to mind. But alongside these well-known men are the stories of some inspired and inspiring women. Women who were willing to defy social norms and traditions with a dauntless commitment to God's word. Sisters in Arms is a collection of 8 true stories following the lives of some of the most powerful and influential women of the Reformation. Beginning with a story of Katharina von Bora, a runaway nun, and spanning 2 centuries to take in the story of Marie Durand, an imprisoned Huguenot. These stories are as revolutionary as they are rare. If you haven't already grabbed your copy, you can get one at the Lineage Journey store on our website, lineagejourney.com/shop. Be sure to get yours today.
Welcome back. We are here with Dr. David Trim at the General Conference, and we're discussing missions. Dr. David Trim is the director of the Adventist Archive and Statistics.
And research.
And research. And he's written numerous books. Most recently, he's written a couple of books on missions. One of them is A Passion for Mission. And you also wrote A Living Sacrifice as well.
Yes, that's right.
You've got some original works on mission, and we're discussing missions, and we've looked at how the church started in America and how it spread abroad. But you did mention earlier that we're going to kind of revisit Switzerland. So Jay and Andrews goes to Switzerland, but how does the request for him to come? Because he's not the first one there.
No. So as I mentioned before the break, in 1859, the first Adventists begin to say, should we be preaching the third angel's message overseas? And the majority answer is no, because we can just preach to immigrants here in our own country. But there were always some people, including James White, and eventually Ellen White, who has a very clear vision about this in 1871, there are always some other people who were saying, no, actually, we do have a responsibility to the rest of the world. And one of them was a man called Michal Czachowski, who was a Polish expatriate. He'd actually been a Roman Catholic priest. He leaves Roman Catholicism. He emigrates to the States. He becomes an Adventist. He has the first Adventist city mission in New York City, right there in the middle of the city in the very early 1860s. And in 1864, he goes to the General Conference and says, send me back to Europe. I want to take these precious truths to the people of Europe. And the General Conference decided no. And to be fair, that wasn't just a matter of conservatism or blindness. I mean, it partly is because of this attitude, we don't need to do this. Mm-hmm. But it's also partly because Tchaikovsky has character flaws. And and they may not be exactly aware of them all, but they can certainly sense some, that this is a flawed individual. And just to sort of underscore that, Tchaikovsky goes to the Advent Christians, who are a rival of Seventh-day Adventists. They're Sunday-keeping Adventists. They're also come out of the Millerites. In fact, they're the ex-Millerite mainstream.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And they had organized their own denomination back in the late 1840s, the Advent Christians, who Ellen White calls the First Day Adventists.
They're still in existence. They are small numbers, but they do still exist.
Absolutely.
I remember seeing a church when I was in New England once, Advent Christian.
Yeah, yeah, and they also have some churches in the Midwest, but they're very, very small, but they do still exist. Tchaikovsky goes to the First Day Adventists, not that they call themselves that, the Advent Christians, and says, send me as a missionary to Europe. And they do. And what he does, he goes to Europe and sends back reports which get published in the Advent Christian paper, and he never mentions that he's teaching them the seventh-day Sabbath. So, I mean, you laugh, and it's easy to laugh at, but it's not exactly an example of ethics.
It's not great integrity.
It's not integrity.
Taking the money from one
and teaching something different. And then, just to make it stranger, he's basically teaching Seventh-day Adventist truths. Mm-hmm. He's teaching the literal premillennial return and imminent return of Christ and the Seventh-day Sabbath. And he builds up, he travels all around Europe, and he builds up a group of what we think are around five companies totaling around 60 people in Switzerland, especially around a small town called Tramelan.
Tramelan, yeah.
But Tchaikovsky isn't an organizer. He's a church planter. He likes to be, and he doesn't like to stay in one place for too long. Mm. So Switzerland is where he's had his biggest success, but he feels like, no, I want to go east. And he goes into Eastern Europe and he leaves the Swiss believers there. But the thing is, Adam, he'd never told them that there was a Seventh-day Adventist church in America.
Yes, it's strange. So he takes money from one church, teaches another church's doctrine,
but then doesn't tell the people tell the people he's teaching that's what he's teaching them, and he ordains two elders, Jakob Erzberger and Albert Vuillemier, and Erzberger and Vuillemier go through Tchaikovsky's papers at one time because he's left quite a lot of his things there in Switzerland, and they discover this journal called the Advent Review and Sabbath Herald, or Review and Herald, and they discover to their astonishment there's a Seventh-day Adventist church in America that believes what they believe. It's actually harder to know who was more astonished, the Swiss believers or the American Adventists, when out of the blue they get a letter from Switzerland saying basically, we're here and
Is it true that the letter was just sent to Battle Creek or something? Or was that a different one?
I think that's a different one.
Okay, okay.
There is a letter from South Africa.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That just gets sent to Battle Creek, but it gets delivered. Mm-hmm. And there's, and I'm drawing a blank now where it was, but there is a part of the world where the local people send a letter to, it's India. It's a group of former Hindus who become Christians in the 1890s, and they send a letter to Sabbath Keepers New York.
Wow.
And remarkably, that gets delivered to the General Conference in Battle Creek, Michigan. So kudos to the U.S. Post Office, and also God must have had his hand in that.
Yeah.
Here's the church leaders in Michigan. We actually have fellow believers in Switzerland. The remarkable thing, Adam, is even after that, you might think that would make people say, ah, yes, we have a responsibility to other people, especially because this isn't just theoretical. Mm-hmm. The Swiss actually send Erzberger. They raise the money to send him to America. He visits Battle Creek. He attends the 1869 General Conference session. He's ordained at the New York Conference camp meeting. Hmm. James White actually writes in the review and says, we have photographs of our believers in Switzerland. Some of us have met them. This isn't a theoretical thing. We've actually met one of their representatives, and yet it still takes another 5 years before Andrews gets sent, which just shows the degree of prejudice that had to be overcome.
Wow. Wow.
But so Tchaikovsky is there. You also have a woman called Hannah Moore, who had been a missionary sent to West Africa, and she comes back to America and is converted by Stephen Haskell while she's on her furlough in America.
Okay.
She doesn't get baptized, but she starts believing the Sabbath, and she goes back to West Africa, and she actually writes, she subscribes to the review, and she writes to the review and says, you know, you have a faithful Sabbath keeper here in West Africa, and I look forward to the day when we have a Sabbath-keeping church. Now, that's dropping a pretty big hint. Adopt me as your missionary. And yet, they don't have to pay the expense of sending her or any of that. Because she's already there. But this is too radical a concept for them, especially with their parochial ideas. But she actually does baptize a few people into believing the seventh-day Sabbath. We don't know what becomes of them. Once Adventists go back to West Africa in the 1890s, there's no trace of any connection back to the 1860s. But still, so there's an example of somebody else who is kind of unofficial.
Would you put LaRue in that same category or not?
All right, so no, I wouldn't put him in the same category, but there's an interesting category, which is people who are the first Adventists in an area without being missionaries sent.
Okay.
And so one of them is a man called Herbert Ribton, an Irishman from Dublin, who was living in Italy. And he reads Adventist literature, and in 1876 he becomes an Adventist. Andrews visits Italy from Switzerland and baptizes him. He's living in Naples, and he starts his own ministry. He starts his own church. He's not a missionary per se, because he was already living there converted by literature, but he begins his own ministry. And then actually he does go as a missionary because he goes to Egypt and starts the Adventist work in Egypt. Unfortunately, he's killed in a civil war there in 1882, and his work, the small group of believers he built up, who were all foreigners, all returned to their homelands. So it's not until the late 1890s that you have Adventist missionaries go to Egypt and stay. But nevertheless, you have to credit Ribton and his boldness and his faithfulness. You also get the first Seventh-day Adventist in South Africa is actually an Adventist from Nevada, the U.S. state of Nevada, called Hunt. He'd been a gold miner and silver miner in Nevada and California. And in the mid-1880s, after the gold rush in California, you get a diamond rush in South Africa. And so he goes to South Africa to prospect for diamonds. And he is the first Seventh-day Adventist in South Africa, and he witnesses to his faith. You know, he's the only diamond miner who on a Saturday isn't busy working and trying to find diamonds. Instead, he sits outside his tent and reads Adventist literature and keeps the Sabbath in his own way. And the first missionaries go to South Africa because there's an appeal from South Africa. There's a man called Peter Wessels, an Adventist, a farmer who is struck by the fourth commandment and says, I'm going to become a Sabbath keeper. And he thinks he's the only Seventh-day Sabbath keeper in the world. And then a friend says, no, there's this American diamond miner called Hunt. And so they go to talk to him, and he explains there actually is this thing called the Seventh-day Adventist Church. He shares some literature with them. They become convinced that the Seventh-day Adventists have the truth. And so they write to the General Conference and say, send us a missionary. And they actually raise money to help pay the expense. And LaRue is an example of that. LaRue is a Californian. He wants to be a foreign mission. We don't know why, but for some reason he wants to be a missionary to China. And he goes to the General Conference. He's already in his 60s and says, send me as a missionary to China. And this is just, we don't know why they say no. It may be just that China is a step too far at this early stage.
Was it his age? I've heard that.
I think it was, we don't know, but it was probably also his age, that he's already in his 60s. So they say, go to an island in the Pacific. So initially he goes to Hawaii, which at that point was an independent country.
Yeah,
it was
a
kingdom of Hawaii, exactly. It didn't become American until the 1890s. So he is a foreign missionary. He goes to Hawaii and sells Adventist literature and also sells Adventist fruit, Adventist health foods, fruit and nut, to support himself. So he's a worker, but he's entirely self-supporting, as had been Herbert Ribton, for that matter. And so he goes to Hawaii, but after a couple of years, he says, no, I want to go further. And so the story goes that he looked on a map and saw the island of Hong Kong, knew that it was a British port, and said, well, Hong Kong, it's only just off the coast of China, but strictly speaking, it is an island in the Pacific. So I'll go to Hong Kong. And he goes there in 1889. The church doesn't send church-paid missionaries to supplement him. They don't arrive until 1902. So he's there for 13 years by himself. And so there are other examples of the church starting because of the spread of Adventist literature. So, for example, the first missionaries to West Africa, I said that, you know, Hannah Moore was there in the 60s, but the first missionaries go in the 1890s, again because of an appeal. There's local people who've read Adventist literature that has somehow made its way to what was then called the Gold Coast, today's country of Ghana. They read it. They say, yes, we're convicted. And so they write to the church headquarters and say, send us a missionary. We want to know more. We want to be taught more Bible truth.
I think I was reading somewhere. I think it's Colombia, similar story.
Yes.
A box of books was left at the port or something.
Across the Caribbean.
Yeah.
What Adventists do is they will give sea captains a box of Adventist books or tracts and ask them to distribute them when they arrive. Now, this seems, I mean, Adam, does this not seem a really chancy way of doing mission? If you know, who knows how many sea captains just threw it in the sea themselves?
Yeah.
Others actually seem to have just literally put it on the dock once they arrive and said, right, I've done that. But we know that happened because the first Adventist in Barbados gets converted by discovering a box of Adventist tracts on the dock.
Wow.
There may have been, we think there are others, and this is how the church started in the Gold Coast in Ghana, because the missionaries actually did, the sea captains actually did make some effort to distribute these tracts.
Hmm.
But, you know, it seems a very chancy way, and yet God somehow worked through that.
Yeah. Fascinating. So, what's the average age of these missionaries? I mean, we said that LaRue is, he was considered possibly too old, but we don't, not much sure. But the other missionaries that go out, is there a general age, or is it a huge range of like 20s to 50s? Or?
That's a great question. In the 70s and 80s, the answer is I'm not sure because I haven't done the research.
Okay.
But I mean, I think you'd be looking at people in their 40s or 50s.
Okay.
But once you get into the 1890s, as the church's mission really starts to take off, the 1890s and the early 1900s, very often missionaries are in their 20s.
Hmm.
In fact, maybe the majority. They're young people. Often, they're only just married. In fact, what you find repeatedly is people, the church doesn't like to send single men, especially as missionaries.
Yeah.
And so what you find is people get married, and then within a week, they go to the mission field. And it's not always clear whether they didn't get married partly so that they could go as as missionaries, though their marriages mostly seem to be happy. So, you know, I don't mean that as a criticism, but you know, these are young people. They're often just out of college. They've been convicted by the call of God in their hearts. They get married so that they can go as missionaries, and they do, and they go.
So we're entrusting the work. These were pioneer missionaries back then.
We are absolutely talking about pioneer missionaries, not necessarily the first, but among the first.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people who are actually going to be teaching Adventist truths. Mm. These are, and we are entrusting the church to people in their 20s, which today we're much less likely to do.
Yeah, well, there's also a difference, I think, in maturity between a maybe 20-year-old now and
that's possible, but you're still talking about people who are vastly inexperienced.
That's true. So, like, they've never traveled to these countries. They don't know any cultural adaptation, and
they haven't had any training in that. And they may have been grown up or had part of their childhood as Adventists, but they've had very little experience working, and yet the church is putting its future in the hands of these young people, and it worked out.
Hmm. So you're a son of missionaries,
yes,
in India, but you also grew up in Australia, and so there's the work in Australia was started, as you mentioned, by Haskell was there,
yes,
but also Ellen White went there,
yes, very very early on in the 1890s, so less than 10 years after the first missionaries go to Australia, Ellen White goes there, and she spends over 9 years in Australia.
9 years there. Now, you probably talked about this at length, but What's your take on why she went there or her mission? So was she planning to go there and come back, or was she just going to go and stay there?
She didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't necessarily feel that this was where she was being called. The Australians had the audacity to ask for her. The Australians said, we believe Sister White would make a tremendous contribution.
Mm.
Could she come? Ellen White had just had a GC session at which she'd been convicted that Adventists needed to do more for African Americans. And she had told church leaders this and had got a negative response.
Hmm.
And church leaders, I think it's fair to say, probably felt that there's no question that they thought she was a prophet. And indeed, every year that she's in Australia, she sends testimonies back to General Conference sessions, and they read them out in General Conference sessions, and you can read the minutes. And people are, they read them out and people are weeping and convicted and say, yes, we're convicted by this testimony, because she normally writes to them and says, you need to be doing better. Mm-hmm. But people take it seriously. So there's no question that people think she's a prophet. But I think it's also the case that a prophet is easier to live with when she's a month's sailing distance mm-hmm. away.
Yeah.
And so this issue over African Americans and the way they were treated probably makes church leaders willing to say, yes, let's send Ellen White to Australia. And she initially is resistant, but she feels that's where God is calling her. Mm. She doesn't know when she goes whether she'll come back because she's already at a relatively advanced age. She was already, let's see, 19, she would have 20, been 18. In her 60s. Yeah. She's already probably older than James White was when he died. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know if she'll come back, but she feels that God is calling her. So she and her second son, William C. White, or usually known just as Willie White, mm-hmm. went to Australia and made a tremendous contribution there.
Well, the Australians, I think, were right. She did really tremendously bless the work there.
Absolutely, but also it has an effect on her. What you see in her writing about mission is a trajectory. Initially, it's about America, then it's about America and Europe, and it's about reaching other Christians. It's about reaching other Protestants. Then it starts to be about reaching Catholics.
Okay.
And then when she's in Australia, there's a marked shift, and it becomes talking about, she writes again and again about India, China, Africa, and the islands of the sea.
Hmm.
And I think it's because she's closer to Asia, and she herself, she had been outside America. She spent 2 years in Europe in the 1880s. So she has gone outside. Mm-hmm. And that also, that's when she starts to write about mission to Catholics, because she's actually seen Europe for herself, and she realizes some of the difficulties of mission there and realizes there's a big Catholic population. But in Australia, she's traveled through the islands of the sea, as you say, Adam, and she's closer to Asia. And I think God is, this is the time to send her these messages. And so she keeps writing about it. And if you think about it, India and China, what are you talking about? You're talking about the heartlands of what today we would call world religions, Islam, Hinduism, Chinese traditional religions.
Mm.
So God is, the trajectory is from people like us to being people very unlike us, from the farthest stretches of the globe and people who belong to a religion system that is completely different to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the major shift in her thinking that takes place while she's in Australia.
Mm.
And for the 13 years that she lives after she gets back from Australia, 14 years, that continues to be her preoccupation. Mm. It's no longer with mission in America or mission to
everywhere.
It's mission to everywhere, including people of the big religions that are rivals to Christians. She never uses the term world religion because nobody used it at the time. She doesn't really write much about Muslims and not at all, I think, about Hindus, but she's talking about India and China and Africa.
Mm-hmm.
There's no mistaking what she's thinking about.
Interesting fact, because
She makes a difference to Australia, but Australia also makes a difference to her.
Yeah, and then obviously to the wider church.
Yes.
Yeah. So Australia, while she's there, I believe they purchase Avondale.
Yes.
And I think there was only 1,000 or so Adventists at the time, but yet they purchased this massive piece of land. And it's, and I think when I've looked at some other countries in the world, you've got Salusi in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia back then, and you've got Newport College that came on the scene, you know, a few years later, and then in South America. It seemed that these pioneers, they only had a few Adventists in the country, and yet they just went out and bought these.
Regularly. Australian
plots of land.
Yeah, and it's not just in Australia, as you say, though, in it, as well as buying the very large estate that Avondale University, as it now is, sits on. They also founded a large hospital in Sydney.
Sydney Adventist Hospital.
Yeah, exactly. A huge institution, and that was through Ellen White's. Mm-hmm. She was instrumental in that. But yes, Adventist missionaries are remarkable buyers of property. They're remarkably bold, and they buy property in the middle of big cities. The sad thing is, Adam, that very often, in recent years or less, not so recent years, we've sold many of those properties, and now the big cities of the world, it's prohibitively expensive to buy there. And we actually had property in the middle of New York City,
travesty,
in Sydney, in Tokyo.
We still have the church, but we sold half it.
Right, right. And the vision has not been as bold in the, you know, the third or fourth generations as it was in the first.
Hmm. Yeah, it's almost like we lived off their vision and shrunk our land in the process.
Well, I mean, partly it's, and we see this at Newbold, though the current site of Newbold wasn't bought until after World War II, but it was much larger, and they sold parts and parts of it to pay for expenses until eventually now they have very little left. And that did take place in some places, that property was sold slice by slice. Mm-hmm. And not reinvested.
Mm.
Though in other parts of the world, the church has been wiser and shrewder and has reinvested. But in other places, the church looked around and said, I can remember this happening in Australia in the 1980s. We're not having success in the middle of Sydney, so we'll sell the property. And likewise in London.
Mm.
They had property in the middle of London, and we're not having success, so we'll sell it, as opposed to thinking, well, maybe we should hold on to it, because maybe at some point we will have a method that's successful.
Yeah. So Ellen White's in Australia for 9 years. Other countries are entered around a similar time that she goes to Australia, but I haven't been to many of the other countries. I have been to Australia and seen, in a sense, how blessed the church is with sanitarium foods and
you know,
the money they get from that, which was set up as a non-profit. You got the Sydney Adventist Hospital and so on. Do you think that, in a sense, Australia was extra blessed by her presence and the structure of the work? Then
I think so. And no, I mean, I know so, unquestionably. And part of what happens there is that Australians also have a mindset which says that business decisions should be taken by people with some background in business.
Mm.
And that's been a blessing for the Adventist Church.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, maybe at times, actually, as with the example of the property in Sydney, the business mindset was a little too business-oriented and not enough mission-focused. Mm. But one reason Australia has had, and the South Pacific has been blessed by these tremendous institutions that raise funds for the church, mm-hmm. is because they didn't assume that a pastor can do everything.
Mm.
They assumed that if you were going to be making financial decisions, you should have some training in finance or some background in business. And the Australian church was always willing to use people with those kind of background to make business decisions.
Hmm.
But I think also Ellen White brought a breadth of vision.
Hmm.
Like, and when she comes back, she brings it to America. Loma Linda gets founded partly mm-hmm. based on Ellen White's visions. Uh-huh. That Ellen White says, yes, we should buy here. This is the place to go. They needed a replacement for Battle Creek because of the apostasy of John Harvey Kellogg, which means that Battle Creek has been effectively lost,
mm-hmm.
even though it remained. There were many Adventists still living there. Battle Creek Church was the biggest church in Adventism into the 1920s.
Uh-huh.
But the medical institutions have been lost. Mm-hmm. And so they have to create a new Battle Creek.
Yeah.
And they do that at Loma Linda. And that's thanks not least to Ellen White, who by this time has come back from Australia.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. I remember hearing you do a lecture at, I think it was Newbold. And it was based on your book, A Passion for Mission. And something you said there got me thinking a little bit. And you mentioned how a lot of missionaries went from Scandinavia to back, you know, would have been West or East Africa.
Right.
And one of the countries I remember you mentioned was Denmark. They sent, I think, 300, if I'm correct, or if I remember. I can't remember exact numbers, but it was a lot of missionaries they sent out. And then today, you see the church in some of these countries really struggling. I've heard it said, and I don't have the reference, maybe I should have got the proper reference, that, you know, when we support the mission field, the work at home is strengthened, right. And so on. Now, is that true, and can we abuse that, and you know what I mean?
Probably can. You're thinking of Ellen White's statement that says the prosperity of the work in the home fields depends on the reflex influence of the evangelical work done in fields afar off.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Ellen White writes that in the early 1900s, and I believe it's true. In fact, I've done a statistical assessment of giving for mission and more or less empirically shown that it's true for America. And when she wrote this, there were American church leaders who basically said, no, we either have enough funds, given our membership, mm-hmm. we either have enough funds to do mission effectively in the United States, or we can do the rest of the world. We can't do both.
Mm.
And actually, as Adventists took on more and more foreign mission fields, tithes and offerings came in more and more.
Hmm.
They always did have enough money to do both.
Hmm.
And you can speak to individual conference presidents even today who in the last sort of 15, 20 years, their conference has adopted a mission field and worked for it and sent money there. And they would all say, there has been we've seen our tithe and offerings go up. The South American division has spent something like $20 million in the last 10 years on missionaries that they fund, not the general conference that they fund. They took reserves money in the bank, but I just heard this in a meeting this week. The money has all come back and more.
Wow.
Because people are inspired by the commitment that the division is showing, and they want to give to support this church that has such a noble and expansive vision. And it's striking that in those years when missionaries were being sent out regularly from Scandinavia and Britain is when the greatest growth was felt. I mean, now, that's too easy to say, because also what's happened since the 1960s is that Europe has become postmodern and post-Christian.
Yeah, so
and it's desperately difficult to work in. So there are other reasons. It is, but nevertheless, it is the case that one has to say that for a while at least, when Britain, Scandinavia, the Netherlands were sending their best and brightest to the mission field, they also were experiencing growth in their home fields. Now, it is possible that at times they sent too many of their best and brightest and didn't reserve enough to work in their homeland. And they may almost have raised up the work in East and West Africa at the expense of something happening in their homeland. So I think there does have to be a balance in who one sends. One has to keep some talent at home to do the mission at home as well.
Keep training and nurturing,
But really, and Ellen White was really talking about the generosity of members. Will there be the funds?
Okay.
And that, as I say, is empirically true.
Okay. Where are we seeing mission trends today? Like, where are the hotspots, or where are the places where missionaries need to go? Because a lot of these places you mentioned, like East and West Africa, they now have local leadership.
Right.
And
there are still parts of West Africa that desperately need to grow. It's interesting, West Africa is almost bipolar in terms of the church, because you've got some parts that are incredibly strong, like Ghana and parts of Nigeria. But then you've got all the Muslim countries of West Africa, which are vast swathes of West Africa, where the church has almost no presence. The church has had missionaries there for more than 100 years, and in some cases has 100 members. So that's not much of a return.
Yeah, yeah.
But, of course, it's very difficult to work in because of the culture. North Africa, Middle East, Western Asia, these are all, you know, the Islamic heartlands. There are parts of East Africa too. East Africa, I mean, is the largest division of the world church, is the East Central African division. But you look, there's a huge Muslim population in Ethiopia, and you've got Somalia, Djibouti, and Eritrea, which are effectively Islamic countries, and where the church has almost no presence. And when the church does win people, they have to take them out of Somalia, for example. They have to take them out of Somalia to Kenya to baptize them. And then when they go back, they can't publicly witness to their faith, or they'd be killed. So they have to be house churches and work very covertly. So parts of West Africa, the whole of North Africa, the Middle East, West Asia, Central Asia, and actually parts of Southern Asia and China. The church is growing in Southern Asia and China, and yet we have huge people groups there in which the church has virtually no presence. And the other place I would say, Adam, some that's dear to your heart and my heart, is Europe, which once was a mission homeland for Adventists. And now many of the unions in the two European divisions are shrinking, and have been shrinking actually for decades. The church in Europe, or at least many countries in Europe, not all, but many countries in Europe, is arguably no longer strong enough to evangelize itself. It needs help. It needs resources, and it needs...
There's not enough people going to just to fill the ranks of being pastors, let alone anything else.
So it needs money, and it needs missionaries, and it needs prayers from the rest of the world church. So North America beginning to feel the effects of postmodernism and secularism, but still very, very successful. Though the trend is clear, and we shouldn't close our eyes to it, but nevertheless, still very successful. Inter-America, South America, Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, the islands of the South Pacific, the church is tremendously successful. And in the islands of Southeast Asia, Philippines, and to some extent Indonesia. The mainland of Southeast Asia is like East Asia, Central Asia, Southern Asia, is very, very tough.
Where are missionaries going? You mentioned South America putting 20 million or whatever in. Would you say that more missionaries are going from South America?
Yes.
Than any other part of the world?
Missionaries never used to go from South America. In fact, if I can say this without causing offense, the truth is South America never used to be that interested in the rest of the world church. Their attitude was almost of, well, just let us get on and do our thing.
Mm.
And that's completely changed, and it changed under the leadership of Ayrton Kohler, who's now the General Conference Secretary. South America is now a vibrant force, has sent many missionaries to the Middle East and North Africa, and missionaries to China as well.
Okay.
And not only recruiting missionaries that are funded by the GC, but missionaries that it has funded itself, and pouring money and other resources to help mission initiatives in China and the Middle East as well. And we praise God for that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is still the case that missionaries disproportionately come from North America.
Okay.
But whereas once missionaries all came from North America, Europe, and Australasia, today they really do come from everywhere. Part of my job is I get to travel the world a lot to visit the church in different places. And I have met Mexican and Filipino missionaries in particular all around the world. So really it is a matter today of missionaries going from everywhere to everywhere.
What are the needs of mission work right now, would you say? Like the main needs, like more or more money?
Yes,
both.
We need more missionaries. And the problem is that the church works a little bit slowly. The church has a very elaborate structure, and I'm not one who thinks that's a bad thing, because I think it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that it's not well understood. In my experience, once you explain to church members what the structure does and how the different levels have different purposes, they say, oh, right, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the structure, at times we are not nimble. Mm-hmm. We're not
like
agile, and we're slow to respond. And so the church has set up an online platform for linking people who want to be involved in mission with opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers of people who have signed up to be willing to serve as volunteers or missionaries long-term or short-term volunteers is many, many times greater than the number of opportunities available to them. So what we need is for the church to embrace the possibilities of missionaries again. We kind of got to the stage, Adam, where we thought we don't need missionaries. And it's true. If you look at, say, East Africa, you'd never send a missionary from Sweden to Ethiopia today, or from Britain to Kenya or Uganda today to conduct an evangelistic campaign, because they've got local people who can do it better.
In the language.
In the language, yeah. Culturally sensitive, and for a fraction of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost sight of, we became so caught up with the success in Inter-America, South America, East Africa, South Africa, that we lost sight of all those big parts of the world that we were just talking about. That have desperate need. So what we need is for the church to embrace the possibilities of missionaries once again and to find projects. They won't all be for long-term missionaries. Mm-hmm. But for some parts of the world, a missionary needs to go for 10 years, because otherwise they lose the expertise, they lose the relationships that they've built.
Mm.
There are parts of the world where you have to think that it's going to take several years to make one convert. You can't do an evangelistic series and convert somebody within a few months. It takes years of relationship building. So you need missionaries to go long term. But there are also places and opportunities for short-term projects as well. And so that is something that the General Conference is pushing at the moment, and divisions, I think, are starting to embrace it. The idea of, yes, let's have more projects, a mix of short-term and long-term. Let's embrace the idea of missionaries again, but let's now send them to where they need to go. We don't need to send missionaries to some parts of the world anymore, because the church has tremendous mission success there. The church may not be rich in money there, but it's tremendously successful. And so we need to instead be putting our world church resources into where the church is weak. And you know what, Adam? That's what we've done since the first. When we founded the General Conference in 1863, it was partly so that you could take resources from where the church was strong and apply them to where it was weak.
Hmm.
And because we've done that for 160 years, we have the world church we have today.
Amen. Amen. Last question. Your favorite missionary?
That's
a
great
question.
Do you have
one?
Well,
I'm sure you've got loads.
Two. One is William Spicer, who's best known for not being a missionary. He was General Conference Secretary for 19 years, General Conference President mm-hmm. for 8 years. And he, I think, more than any other one individual, implanted mission in the Adventist DNA.
Okay.
By his relentless traveling, speaking, and writing, published hundreds and probably thousands of articles about mission mm-hmm. and missionaries. But he himself had been a missionary. He was a missionary to England
and
then was a missionary to India. He was superintendent of the India mission when there were only a handful of missionaries for the entire vast subcontinent of India. So he was a missionary himself, but that was a relatively small part of his career. My favorite missionary in terms of somebody who was long-term would be George D. Keogh, an Irish-British missionary who went to the Middle East in 1908 and then served there until 1930, went back in 1937 and stayed until 1942, and then came to the General Conference to work there for 4 years, and then went back to the Middle East for another 8 years.
Wow.
So he went to the Middle East the third time when he was 65, literally at the age that most people were retiring. He went back and served for another 8 years and didn't want to go home when they eventually said, no, it's time for you to go back. And then taught at Newbold College into his 80s.
Wow.
He was a incredibly open-minded missionary. He was doing things that were cutting edge by the standard of any Protestant missionary, much less Adventist. And he was doing them. We had to rediscover them. He was doing these things in the 1910s and 1920s that Adventists at the Institute for World Mission and the Department of World Mission at the Seventh-day Adventist Theological Seminary rediscovered in the 70s.
Wow.
And he'd been doing them 50 and 60 years earlier.
Wow.
But the most important thing was that he was incarnational.
Hmm.
I've been to Egypt where I spoke with the grandchildren of people who still told stories about him and related how their parents and grandparents told them how, even though he was a European, he came into their houses, he sat on the mud brick floor with them and ate whatever they put in front of him.
Hmm.
And as one of them told me, what he learned from his grandparents was that people saw the real Christianity instead of talking about Christianity. And so through that incarnational ministry, he won people where nobody else was having any success winning people in the Middle East.
Wow. And his name again?
George Keogh.
George Keogh. Oh. Is he the one that Keogh House is named
after? Yes, there's Keogh House, the dormitory that I lived in when I was a student. Newbold is named after George Keogh.
Oh, wow. Okay. For someone who's listening, who's thinking of maybe this has sparked something in them about doing mission work themselves, a sentence for them.
Go to vividfaith.com. That's vividfaith.com.
Okay.
Or go to adventistmission.org.
Okay.
And vividfaith.com will connect you with opportunities to be involved in mission projects.
Mm-hmm.
AdventistMission.org will tell you about what's happening in the mission field and give you an opportunity to pray or to give for mission projects. Mm.
Okay, thank you for those two websites, vividfaith.com.
Yes, and AdventistMission.org.
And AdventistMission.org. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Trim, for taking the time to share with us. And
pleasure.
And I pray that this will inspire someone into mission, and as they see the stories from the past, it may spark something in them to go and do mission work today. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your work here at the General Conference as well, in all you do for the World Church. And I pray that it will continue to be fruitful in inspiring people for mission.
Thank you, Adam.
For those who've been listening, thank you for tuning in to this Lineage Journey podcast. And I pray that you take on board what has been shared today. And if God is calling you to be a missionary, that you would not put it off 5 years or 10 years, but see how you can do it at the earliest possible opportunity to go and share the gospel wherever it may be, maybe a new country, maybe a new town, maybe a new city, maybe a new state, but take seriously God's call upon your life. Thank you for tuning in to Lineage Journey podcast. If you want more information, please go to www.lineagejourney.com.
Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Lineage Journey is supported by your generous donations. Did you know that you can donate on a monthly basis? Any amount, from $2 to $100 or whatever you decide, through patreon.com/lineagejourney. Your donations go towards the cost of producing our varied content, and we thank you for your support.